From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hi everybody, welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. Back after a week's break, I'm your host Stuart Bulk, joined by my co-host over in Denver, Colorado. Hi John.
Hello.
Okay, John Grace over there. And the other one, who's usually with us, Hunter Dusing, is not here this week. He sadly had to bow out and apologizes for his absence, and he assures us that he'll be back next week. Yeah, we just took a little bit of a week's break, cool the engines and take a bit of a breather and get back into it with this one. And this week, we're going to be talking about, shortly, the Hoy Brothers classic from 1988, Chicken and Duck Talk, one that we've been talking about for the longest time, one I've been pushing, and yourself as well, John, to get done, and it's just sort of never eventuated. And for those of you who have been following us from way back when, the BJ era, as opposed to the AJ era, we did actually talk about Chicken and Duck Talk on episode, I can't remember what number it was, really, really, like within the first five episodes, I believe it was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was way, way back. It was, and I spoke about it briefly then, but as dedicating a whole episode on it, no, we didn't do that up until now. So that's what the go is for this week, but in the meantime, John, what you been doing with yourself? I want to ask you something. You're the local bee resident on the show. Have you heard about this slaughtering of bees that Bette Midler's been crying about on social media?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen that yet. I've been kind of staying away from social media, especially celebrities. So I haven't heard of this. I actually read a story recently that the bee population is really healthy right now.
Oh, okay. Well, she's got some post up screaming about bees, stop the slaughter of bees somewhere. I don't know what it was because, apparently. Yeah,
they only live about 6 weeks. I don't know what the fucking, what the slaughter is.
Yeah, right.
It's like I've been reading about like the flow hive because I've been researching that. I'm going to try to save up for one and have it going by next summer. All the time on the comment boards, there are these hippies who go, this is not good for the bees, and it's not good for the mentality of the bees. And then some beekeeper will say, bees hate you. They fucking hate you.
Oh, really?
You take their honey. It's like, this instrument, this flow hive, will allow you to get the honey without disturbing the bees. And it's like, and they only live about 6 weeks. The queen lives 2 years. It's,
oh, really?
There is no, like, yeah, there's no big emotional thing. Yeah, you have to replace the queen every couple of years.
I meant to ask you, like, how can you distinguish the queen bee from the regular rank and file bees out there?
Well, she looks different, but she's also sold in a she's in a separate container that you insert into the hive. That's basically she has a doorway made of like a wax candy, and then the bees eat through it and get her out and free her, and then she starts breeding and controlling the hive.
She's like the Kim Kardashian of bees. Are just all the bees just black men trying to eat through the wax candy to get to that bubble butt. Right, right.
There's a reason that the whore madam in Dolomite was called Queen Bee.
So. Oh, Dolomite, I'm so happy.
Then Rudy starts lisping his way through the film and everybody's stunned. He's gay.
Really? I tell you, that's one that we got to talk about when we get Scheme on, is Dolomite. For sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about distinguishing looks. Is she bigger in size, or is it just a color difference?
I don't know. Maybe she's different looking colors in the. I mean, they're different features. You can distinguish between the worker bees and the queen.
You can
if you go online, and it's like you can tell the difference.
Oh, okay then.
Now I don't know what it's like when you actually have a hive, if you can see the queen or not, but that's something I'm going to find out next year.
Oh, so you're really gonna buy this flow hive, are you?
Yeah, I got to save up for the flow hive and then probably spend a couple of weekends building it. Although, as you said, if it's Australian, it's going to be pretty easy to put together. So,
I guarantee there'll be none of that IKEA shit, headaches to it.
eight friggin' hours sitting here building like a shelf, you know, because of cartoon instructions from IKEA.
It'll probably come like 3/4 assembled already. It's like, yeah, mate, we've already done all the hard work for you. Just, you know, slot this in here and put this hook up and be right.
Video. They're like, oh, you just put this on here. You just put this on here, and then just like, and then they have like cranking out the honey right away.
Wow, that's crazy. All right. Well, there's some more beekeeping facts for you from our resident beekeeper, John Grace. And, yeah. All right. Seen the movies at all this week, mate?
Gosh, I saw a double feature of two old Toho movies, War of the Gargantuas and Monster Zero with the Alamo Draft House. So I haven't seen anything new.
Lovely.
Haven't had a big interest in seeing anything new these days. It's I can't say the current movie scene. I mean, we say it all the time, but
yeah.
I really have to say it's kind of boring. I did take my kid to see Max, that all ages family movie about the it's like the war dog, like the German Shepherd that's used for sniffing out bombs over in the Middle East, and then the soldier dies, so the dog comes back, and then his younger brother adopts the dog. But of course, they have to throw in a weapon selling ring and everything to bring in some action. But what's so funny is it's directed by Boaz Yakin, and it's written by Sheldon Lettich. So it has these guys who are like from Canon Films.
Oh God, Sheldon Lettich. He's a Van Damme staple. He was as a writer and director as well.
Yeah. Also a Vietnam vet, believe it or not.
He's oh really?
Okay. Yes. And it was a total surprise. I just took my kid cause it hit the second run and I just wanted to see a cheap movie and he wanted to see something and I didn't feel like seeing a cartoon and went to see this and I actually enjoyed it despite all kind of the silliness and the hokey B movie cliches. Cause I said, well, at least it's encouraging kids to get the hell away from the computer
and
actually like ride bikes and own a dog and all these other things. It was far more, far better than I expected it to be. Probably because my expectations were low and, you know, paying like a $2 or $3 second run ticket fee. So it's, I couldn't complain. It's like we walked out, had a good time. My kid liked it, you know, because
Kato, dad's a cheapskate. He's trying to save his money for the Flow Hive, so he's going to take it to $2 theater.
I think he gives it, well, he likes the Elvis because it's actually smaller. And I think kids are a little put off by the oversized theaters.
Yeah.
Seeing something like this.
Oh, it gets very intimidating, the size of the screen, the theater, and all the other.
He's like five, so you just don't know how he's going to want to behave in one of those big, nice new theaters where it's like $11 a ticket. So it's like $2, $3. Hey, if he hates it, we can just leave. We went to see Tomorrowland. I almost thought we were going to walk out.
Oh, really?
And an hour and a half into it, he's just looking at the ceiling and asking me about the water stains and stuff. Like, are there stains? Why are the water stains? I said, well, because it rains and they don't fix the roof. And it's like the movie's just not pulling him in.
Yeah. I mean,
for like an hour it worked and then it's like,
90 minutes is plenty for a kid's film. The credits should be up and done by that time.
Right.
Really.
And that's what I like about Max. Max was like, I think it barely hit 100 minutes, if even that. I was like, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
But Tomorrowland was pompous ass, 2 hours and 10 minutes, and George Clooney looking smug and miscast and. A message and plot that just falls apart in the third act. Like a lot of movies these days, they don't really know how to end anything.
Yeah, that's the same for one of the films I saw. By the way, if you do want to see a good film, a good kids movie that's just an easy watch, 90 minutes in and out, it's watch an Australian one called Paper Planes, if you've got it
Paper
over
Planes.
There. It's a lot of fun. I took my boys to see it when it came out, and we've now got it at home here on Blu-ray, and it's a great little film to watch. It's a lot of fun. I think you'll enjoy it.
I can rent it from Amazon Video for $3.99, apparently.
There you go. I think you'll enjoy it. He'll just have to get his head around the Australian accents, that's all. But
Right.
Yeah. I watched quite a few movies this week, actually, upstairs. I watched Sin City again. I rewatched that. Enjoyed that a lot. Then I watched Sin City 2 for the first time. I'd never seen it.
Yeah.
And it was okay. I watched it in 3D. There was JB had a special on, buy two, get one free, and they even had 20% off that price. So the films I picked up, which were Sin City 2 in 3D, Machete Kills, and Dumb and Dumber 2, whatever it was. the boys love Dumb and Dumber. I already got that, so I thought I'll pick it up for them. Yeah. I mean, that set me back about $25 for the three of them, so it's not that much, really.
Right.
So I enjoyed Sin City 2 for the most part, but it was not as good as 1. No way. I really enjoyed again watching it. I really had a lot of fun with it.
I picked up Sin City on Blu-ray and have never revisited the film. It's just sitting on my shelf waiting for me to finally break the plastic on it. Like, I liked it in the theater. I thought it was way better than I expected it to be. Sin City 2, I think I kind of half liked it. Like, I liked some of the segments in it, but then I thought the Jessica Alba, Mickey Rourke thing at the end was just a disaster.
Yeah, it didn't finish well. It really did not finish well. I watched Machete again and really enjoyed that. So I noticed that every film I was watching was a Rodriguez film as well.
I never liked Machete. So I did. I watched about 5 minutes of Machete Kills and on Netflix and kind of just gave up.
Oh, really? Okay. I've not.
Yeah, I was going to run it in the background while I worked, you know, because I telework from home. Some people know. And I was just going to have it on as background noise and haven't gotten. I might do that if it's still on Netflix and run it as background noise. But I don't enjoy those films because I think Rodriguez kind of doesn't know if he really wants a spoof or he wants to make a straightforward action movie. So it kind of dances on both sides. I don't really care for that.
Yeah, okay. I really enjoyed Machete. I listened to I watched Machete with the audience reaction track that's on there. And it was a lot of fun. It was actually because I watched upstairs in my theater, so it was like being in a theater, but you're on your own, obviously. I actually felt like being in a room full of ghosts who were laughing because I'm the only person there. it's like, yeah, there's all this laughter, but it's just me.
I actually think they should for these Chinese. Or for the classic Hong Kong comedies, they should have an audience track like a Chinatown theater where they're laughing at all this stuff that we don't get because we don't get the joke in the subtitles because it's some Cantonese slang that we don't quite catch. And then you always have the guy in the back that had the throat problem who's going, he's like, everybody I've ever talked to, white, Chinese, black, they always, when they saw something in Chinatown, there was always an old man in the back going, it doesn't matter if it was New York or San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Or Los Angeles. Apparently, the old man with the phlegm problem was always there. It was a severe coughing problem.
He probably did the same thing I did years ago. I may have brought the story up on the show in the past. I can't remember. If I did, it was so long ago, I've forgotten. And years and years ago, like, it has to be like 20 years ago, I was... with a friend of mine, and we were broke as fuck. I mean, we were working, but we were just like, I think it was like the day before payday, we were just pretty much broke as fuck, the two of us, and we're like, we need to get loaded and just get a drink of some sort, you know? And like, beer was too expensive, even cask wine was out of our range, we had like $4. So we went to an Asian grocer, and we saw this Chinese cooking wine. Like, fuck, $2 for a bottle. It's got like 40% alcohol in it. Awesome.
Oh, God.
We took a swig of that each, and we were fucked. And we're just like, this is gross. We can't even finish this shit. It's just, it was bad. So, I've had it again in the past, previously, but always for cooking, never for consumption, straight out of the bottle.
Right.
Yeah, it was, that's a sign of desperation there, folks. Yeah, that was rough as all shit. But, so I'm saying that guy who's probably got the throat problem was, probably doing the same thing as we did because he sounds like he was hacking like me and Jeremy were that day. It was not pleasant.
Or smoking cigarettes, as there's no taboo on smoking cigarettes in their culture. They don't care.
No?
No.
Oh, really?
It doesn't exist. If you go to China, they just people puff away on cigarettes like crazy.
Wow. Okay.
It's funny because, like, Jackie Chan... always been a chain smoker. Supposedly gave it up a few years ago. I don't know if I'd believe that. Donnie Yen, chain smoker. A lot of those guys smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe. They just don't. And I'm sure the health warnings are there. They just don't care.
You know? Well, Jackie Chan probably figures I'm going to die in a stunt somewhere in a film one day. So
yeah,
what's
he's
the point?
Like, who cares? The fast die young. You know, his drinking is like legendary too.
Yeah, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Massive drunk. They said the stuntman. You know, back when he had a stuntman club, I think he fired most of those guys, but they would kind of pal around with him at nightclubs, and he would just get wasted. And there were all these stories in the Hong Kong newspapers about Jackie Chan crashes wedding drunk, you know, like he's just on a rampage. And I said, well, hell, that sounds more fun than the Boy Scout he tries to present himself as in movies. You know, it's like,
yeah,
he sounds like a party animal. It's like Jackie's a partying lunatic. And I guess he got in trouble for that. Like a friend of mine who lives in China said, oh yeah, he got in trouble for like stashing weapons and bombs in his mansion.
Jesus.
Yes.
That's crazy.
He's a crazy man. You know, it's just like I don't think that guy wants to retire. I think he just wants to die trying, you know.
Did you ever notice that Jackie Chan, when he gives interviews, pretty much says the same thing over and over and over?
Yeah,
right?
It's a rehearsed script that he just, I think, his old manager, Willie Chan, who he also fired, basically had him memorize a complete script to say the same stuff all the time. And I've heard he's a two-faced phony. Which wouldn't surprise me.
No, because he always says, like, oh, about him and Bruce Lee's different styles of martial arts, like, Bruce kick high, I kick low, whatever, or something. And
To me, he's just a plagiarism of Alexander Fu Xing, the Shaw Brothers actor. Like,
okay.
Really, if you watch Fu Xing's movies before Jackie Chan was making, like, Drunken Master and Snake and Eagle Shadow, if you watch the Fu Xing movies, that's where Jackie Chan is basically swiping his persona. The kind of lively young guy who needs a mentor or whatever to kind of, you know, tame his craziness and teach him the right techniques to beat the bad guy. It's all there, like the humorous kung fu fighter. And I mean, kung fu comedy was around before Jackie Chan was making them.
He reminds me of that guy from Seven Grandmasters, the one who's trying to become a student of the teacher.
Right, and that was, I think, produced to cash in on like Eagle Shadow and the Jackie Chan movies that hit it big. Like Drunken Master and Eagle Shadow were huge hits, and suddenly everybody's like, well, we can go take our crews out to, you know, the new territories and shoot on the mountaintops and shoot these historical kung fu movies. We don't even need sets. So they did. And I think Sam and Grandmasters uses some of the same locations as Drunken Master and Snake and the Eagle Shadow.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yeah.
You know, they do share a lot of the same sets. You'll see the same towns and park areas where they can film. You won't see a car or a modern building or telephone wires.
John, do you know of a film called World of Drunken Master?
Yeah, it's from the director of Seven Grandmasters.
Yeah, yeah.
Cash in.
Yeah, it was.
It's all right.
Yeah, okay, because it's all on the same video label here. I think we spoke about it on VHS Memories, maybe. It was all the same company release, Seven Grandmasters, World of Drunken Master, and I think it was another
same
title.
Same director. Yeah, same director, same
company. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, Joseph Kuo was the director, and he would make those in Taiwan. He also made one that seemed to have inspired some other filmmakers, but he himself was ripping off an old peplum. It was called 18 Bronzemen. And it was like Shaolin having this test chamber with 18 bronzemen, these guys in bronze armor and bronze gold paint, you know, that you had to fight through them to get to the end of the chamber to finish your Shaolin training. So, and it was swiped from like an old Machiste movie or Medusa versus, you know, Hercules against the Mongols or some movie like that where they had 18 bronze men come out from a sorcerer's spell and fight with Hercules. So, or Machiste, or whoever the hell it was, you know.
As long as there's no monsters coming out of the sea, I'll be fine to watch those, I think.
Right. It's like, but 18 bronze men is kind of a classic. That's one I'd like to see the local Alamo Draft House, like maybe screen that for their Hong Kong movie night.
Somebody out there, please release Seven Grandmasters on Blu-ray. I'm dying to get that film again. After I've had to, you know, dig a hole in the ground in my backyard and bury my other one.
Would have been nice if they got around to doing some of the... apparently, they had the rights to do other films. Media Blasters did when they released Seven Grandmasters. They had the rights to do other Joseph Kuo movies like 18 Bronzemen, but the sales on Seven Grandmasters were not good. Of course, now it's impossible to find for a reasonable price.
Yeah.
It's become a item, but back then the sales just weren't that strong.
God, I wish I had ripped a copy of mine on DVD to an MKV file or something, just as a posterity sake.
You probably find it on the torrents, I hate to say.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not gonna harp on about the death of my Seven Grandmasters. That was like 3 years ago or something, so
yeah,
gotta get over that.
I saw that at the Alamo a couple of months back.
Yeah, maybe he's saying as well. How did it look?
Great. It's 35 millimeter print. It was just amazing. It was like being in a New York Chinatown.
There's prints out there that exist of it then. So there's no reason why they can't transfer this shit to Blu-ray.
Oh, no. The prints still exist. The negatives still exist in Hong Kong. That's what they transferred the Media Blasters DVD off of.
Wow. Come on, somebody, get onto that shit. We've been pretty good so far with our requests on Blu-ray. We're still missing When You Come Back, Red Rider, but that's just like an in-joke now that is never going to come on
Yeah, well, luckily we're not the only ones requesting that one. Like, other people have kind of pushed for it. But.
Well, one of the other ones I've actually been asking for here and there, Bobby John the Outlaw, is now getting the Blu-ray release shortly.
Yep.
So
I think Mark Lester, I think, actually owns all prints of all of his movies. And I think
does he really? That's very smart. It's very smart of him to do that.
I know they're working on Truck Stop Women. Supposedly that's a Code Red project.
Didn't he do Roller Boogie? Was that his movie? Or was it?
Mm-hmm.
That was
he did that.
Roller Boogie, that was Mark Lester. Right.
Right.
Cool. All right, no worries then. Now, one other thing I want to do before we launch into Chicken and Duck Talk. I need to, after having heard the last episode we dropped, which was the Mr. Arrow Shelf.
Is that a weirdly titled one?
Yeah, really. Yeah, but people have thought, what the hell is Mr. Arrow Shelf? Mr. Arrow's Health, Mr. Arrow Shelf. Yeah, whatever they want to call it. I need to regrade up the Academy. I think I was a little excessive with my rating of 9.5 because I was on such a Mad Magazine kick. I'm like, oh, I heard the episode back, you know, not long ago. I'm like, shit, 9.5 is a bit high, Stuart, really. So I'm going to regrade it to a more clear-headed score of 7. I think 7 is more. 7 is more appropriate. Not to say I dislike the film any less, downgrading from 9.5 to 7. It's just I'm a bit more clearer on it. Because people would go back and they may watch it. I think John the Rogue Demon Hunter was... yeah, thanks, John, for pointing out that it's available on Vudu for about $2 or $3 to rent out and watch. And I don't want people thinking 9.5, Stuart, really. It's... okay, whatever. But, yeah, 7's a solid, decent score for that film, and I still highly recommend it. So that is that. Okay, so let's get into the main feature we're talking about this week, and is the Hoy Brothers classic from 1988, Chicken and Duck Talk. But before we do that, let's talk about the Hoy Brothers. John, where did you hear of them? What was the first film of theirs you saw, and when, roughly, do you remember?
I first knew them because I was really into the Aces Go Places series, which is what Sam Hui, the brother who's also a singer and a big star in Hong Kong, or music star, even
huge.
Before he was a big, like the father of Canto Pop is what they call him. He did the series called the Aces Go Places series for Cinema City in the 80s, and I really dug those. And then I had read that he was part of the Hui Brothers comedy team. So back when you would rent videotapes from Chinatown grocers, I ended up getting copies of like Games Gambler to Play and Private Eyes and The Contract. And back then, like Games Gambler to Play never had subtitles, but I still watched it anyway because I'm so fascinated by movies from that era.
Yeah.
And The Contract and Private Eyes were widescreen films, crop dead center, so you had those cut-off subtitles that were so annoying. But I still enjoyed the movies, and every time they've been released on DVD, I've bought them, and I bought the recent Blu-ray box set because I love those movies enough where I was like, okay, these are my last permanent copies of these films. I'll never buy these again.
Yeah.
And so I have the original four Hui Brothers films from Golden Harvest from like 1974 to about 1981 with Security Unlimited. Those were really the movies that built Golden Harvest, even more than the Bruce Lee films. It's like those were gigantic hits. Like people have no idea what just phenomenal blockbusters those were for Golden Harvest. It's like it just outgrossed everything. Every time they would release one, biggest Hong Kong movie ever. And then, in fact, when Sam Hui jumped to Cinema City and left Golden Harvest and did the first Aces Go Places film, that became the biggest movie in Hong Kong history, like in terms of ticket sales and you know how many people saw it. But that's when I got into them, was around I'd say about 1991 or so when I started getting them on video.
Now, just as you mentioned, that the Hui brothers are massive, aren't they, in their home country?
Yes.
Huge, yeah. Yet outside of let's say Asia, no one knows them. Hardly anybody knows them, and it's a damn shame because these guys are really funny, really talented.
Yeah, they only know Michael Hui for being in Cannonball Run, and there's a Jeremy Irons movie with Gordon Lee. I think it's called Chinese Box or something, and Michael Hui is an English speaking role in that. He's got like a big supporting role, and that's it. That's all they would know him from, unless you go to like film festivals where they do retrospectives or you know, they showed Michael Hui movies at your art museum or whatever, you know, where, like in Boston. But yeah, they were just barely known outside of Asia. It's funny because Michael Hui was the first Chinese comedy star who was big in Japan because of The Private Eyes. They actually designed that one to be exportable to Japan. It was a monster hit where it was called the Mr. Boo series, and they called it Mr. Boo. So if you say to a Japanese person, oh, have you seen the Mr. Boo movies? They know exactly what you're talking about. That's Michael Hui's film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did not know that. But, yeah, I first saw them in The Private Eyes was my first one. I watched it on the international channel here, SBS. And just for some reason, just must have caught it when it was starting. I'm like, oh, The Private Eyes. And I didn't know if this was some sort of riff on the Tim Conway Don Knotts Private Eyes from 1980, which I really, really liked. Of course, this Private Eyes is from 76, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was a huge fan of the Conway Knotts one that I saw as a kid, and still am. Right. Really like it a lot. So I didn't know if it was a riff on that, if it was an Asian remake or something. I sat down and watched it, and I laughed my ass off. I thought, this is very, very funny, very clever. Yeah. Who the hell is Hui Brothers? I mean, I think that one's only got Michael and Sam, doesn't it? Doesn't have Ricky in it, from memory.
Ricky, I thought Ricky had a cameo.
He may do. He may do.
Or he was a supporting role. It's like, I know that in Game Gambler's Play and The Last Message, which were the first two films of Golden Harvest, Ricky could only have cameos because he was contracted with Shaw Brothers, and he couldn't leave yet to be built in movies. By the time, I think he did come over for The Private Eyes. I think he has a big role. He's a way bigger role in The Contract. He's really the star of The Contract. But I know he started making solo comedies for Golden Harvest when he left Shaw Brothers, and those did really well in... one or two of them were directed by John Woo.
Oh, really? So okay.
John Woo was known as a comedy director for years until he did Better Tomorrow.
Okay.
But for years, he was known as Mr. Comedy doing Ricky Hui. And he co-directed The Private Eyes. And in fact, you could almost say he actually directed The Private Eyes.
Wow. Okay. It's been a long-ass time since I've seen The Private Eyes. Far too long. Very hard to find. If you live in Australia.
He's in that. I'm pretty sure he's in, but he's not the main. Okay. He's not, the main roles are Sam and...
And Michael. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I wasn't...
Seems like it. I mean, I'd have to double check just to be sure, but I think he's in the... I think Ricky's in The Private. It's been a couple of years since I've watched it. And I always watch those in, like... I'll watch them all in, like, a couple of weeks. So they'll totally blur.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's listed as being in The Private Eyes. I think he's got a big... He's got a fairly sizable role in it, but it's mainly... It's mainly a Sam and Michael movie, and Chicken and Duck Talk was made years later after Security Unlimited, which was their last big hit. Also a big Ricky film.
Right, right. And like I said, I watched Private Eyes and laughed, and I thought, wow, really clever. And then, again, getting into Chicken and Duck Talk, I've not seen a great deal of the other ones. Did you say there was one called The Chocolate Inspector that was funny?
That was what Michael Hui did, The Chocolate Inspector, after Sam and had left for Cinema City. So Chocolate Inspector became, I think, one of his first big solo movies for Golden Harvest.
Okay. Yeah, so...
And that was a big hit.
Oh, yeah, it seems like pretty much they do. Everything was pretty much a big hit for the most part. Yeah. So flash forward to Chicken and Duck Talk. It plays again on SBS. And it's like, I had noticed, oh, it's got... Michael Hui and Ricky Hui. I'm like, oh, okay. I remember these guys from Private Eyes, so I want to watch this. And I watched, and I absolutely fell in love with it. I've seen Chicken and Duck Talk now. Honestly, it's got to be at least 15 times. Easily.
Wow.
Easily 15 times. And there's no word of a lie in there or exaggeration. It's just then I can just sit down. I can watch it from start to finish without... any problem whatsoever. However, the only problem that I have had with it, which has I've stated before on the show, was the version I've had of SBS has been the subtitles Australianized in there. So everything's got mate. I thought, no, this is wrong. This mate, there's a cockroach here. Mate, what's this doing in my soup? Mate, what's this dog doing in here? It's like, okay, this is wrong. So it wasn't until very, very recently that I saw it. I watched it with its, I'm guessing, is the true interpretation of the language into the English subtitles. Right. And it made a lot more sense while I was watching it. And, I absolutely love this movie. But and I think the first time I did watch it was about 90, I want to say 94, because I had it on VHS off of SBS, and then they re-ran it again in the early 2000s, and that's when I got onto DVD, onto a DVD-R off that as well. So, and they use the same damn subtitles for the film. They didn't bother updating them or correcting them. It was just like, oh, they just slapped the same old crap on there. But when did you first catch Chicken and Duck Talk?
Strangely enough, I think Garrow had a Laserdisc and sent me a copy VHS tape.
Jeez.
And you know, that was okay for that. And for whatever reason, I ended up losing that tape, or Mississippi humidity got to it or whatever, and I only watched it once and thought it was good, and went to watch it again and my tape was gone, or you know, ruined or rotted or whatever.
Yeah.
So I figure, okay, well, eventually I'll get it on DVD. And recently it came out on Blu-ray, and it's a little unaffordable for me these days. Like, it's, I think it would retail $30 just ordering it from Hong Kong. So I'm like, okay, it's not what I pay for movies nowadays, but you know, I'll wait for the price to drop eventually. So I had to watch this through other means. Somebody was kind enough to provide that, and but I'm gonna get the Blu-ray set eventually, because it also has the front page, which was the true Hooley Brothers reunion movie with all three Hooley Brothers in the film, you know, as the main characters. But that's in a box set with this and Chocolate Inspector, and you know, kind of representing Michael Hooley's post Security Unlimited career.
Yes. Okay. So you saw it. What did you say? The mid '90s, you reckon?
96.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and like I said, I watched it once. Was going to watch it again. Didn't get around to it. This is my second time watching it, which I really, really dug.
Just a second time. Okay.
Just a second time. Just haven't had access to it.
Yeah, I mean, because
it was never widely available, like the way they always reprint the Jackie Chan movies or the John Woo films. These comedies that really only sell in Hong Kong, they don't reissue those that often.
Yeah,
because the audience is so limited for them, and they don't have a huge international following. Oh, this Chicken and Duck Talk was actually a minor cult hit at film festivals, even in America.
Oh,
like,
really?
It was kind of well known. Yeah, I mean, which doesn't count for much, but it means that 30 or 40 people might have seen it at a film festival in Chicago and enjoyed it and talked about it. But it was well regarded. But there's just no market for these films in America.
Do you think,
outside of Chinatown?
Do you think the laziness of Western audiences, and not just American, there's also Australians and the Brits, and they just to actually sit there and watch a comedy film and have to read the subtitles?
Yeah, that's an element, and it's also, it helps to be culturally interested in Hong Kong culture, you know, or interested in their culture, and it requires an understanding of it and Cantonese culture. And for a lot of people, it's too much work to do when they just want to watch a movie. They'd rather watch Jim Carrey just make faces.
Yeah.
It's easier for them. And there's also a thing about comedy, and this is very exclusive to America, I feel, although some Canadians may agree with me. And it's in America, we've got a weird thing about comedy. Like, we think it all has to be one type of thing, which is basically a sitcom on the big screen. Like, it has to be like a Seinfeld episode or Friends. Like, really broad, over-the-top comedy, like that Jerry Lewis, Three Stooges type humor.
Yeah, really.
If you do it today, people don't like it. They think they're too mature for that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the comedy has to be mature. This has to be like a Judd Apatow movie. Like, nobody's really into that. I mean, the Naked Gun movies did well, but generally people will tell you, well, those movies are stupid. They're funny because they're stupid. So Americans have developed this kind of snootiness about comedy, and I think it's one reason we have these horribly unfunny movies that are billed as comedies that are filled with what's called the comedy nerd generation. And these, I don't care for any of this stuff. And I think that's why they're bringing over people like Russell Brand, and they've got these guys who can't act like Seth Rogen. And comedy is really deteriorated in America. It's like, but that's why I like going to these Hooley Brothers comedies or the Stephen Chow comedies that were made in the last decade or so, because there's a lot of visual gag humor that's missing from Western filmmaking.
Plus, the thing is, as well, these films are really, I speak of Chicken and Duck Talk and the Hooey Brothers movies, are very subtle. They don't try and sell you the joke like a Seth, what's that guy, Seth Rogen, that's like, has to be loud about it to make sure like you got a hearing problem.
40 years old and I'm talking about pot. You know, it's just like, that's all there.
Yeah, yeah. Everything in this film is very subtle. There's, you know, and the thing that I found out as well that I was thinking about last night was, a lot of comedies, and this goes across the board, not just in the US or North America, a lot of comedies these days seem to have a mean spirit run through them.
Yeah.
Which this film does not at all.
Right. Sure, well, a lot of American comedies, I'll tell you exactly why, a lot of American comedies are written by nerds that got beat up by rednecks when they were in high school.
Exactly. And
That's what it is. And in Hong Kong, it's not like that. Like, this movie, Chicken and Duck Duck, is about the westernization of Hong Kong food.
Yep.
You know, the rival restaurant in the movie is basically represents the West, like coming in and encroaching on Cantonese food culture. So it's got a whole subtle meaning to it. It's not, you know, Seth Rogen getting back at somebody who plucked his ear in the fourth grade or something, you know. Talking about pot, you know.
I've learned to very dislike him a lot.
I can't stand him for the Green Hornet, so I was just done.
I mean, I will say this, I did like the interview, but I think James Franco said that a lot more than what Seth Rogen did. But anyway, let's get off that. So Chicken and Duck Talk is about a miserly guy played by Michael Huey, brilliantly played by Michael Huey, called Old Huey. Well, that's what he's known as in the Australian one. I've never seen that Old Huey roll up in any other ones in the subtitles. Right. Who's a proprietor of a duck restaurant, like roast duck and all that sort of stuff. And his conditions in his restaurant are not the cleanest, let's say that. His staff are pretty much inept and lazy. He has cockroaches running around. at the start, a guy comes in with his wife and takes a seat, and there's a cockroach in the soup. And turns out the guy who actually is there with his wife is a health inspector, and they're trying to prove to him that it's not a cockroach, it's actually a raisin or a date or something. And it's like, oh, it's edible, it's good for you. And he's like, no, look, there's legs in the soup. And the inspector walks, storms out, like, I'm gonna have you shut down, blah blah blah. Anyway, so across the road, and you see also with Michael Huey's character, we'll call him Old Huey for the sake of this, he lives upstairs above the restaurant with his wife and his son. And his mother-in-law was coming into town to stay with him, and his mother-in-law is rich, very well off. And he's like got a table that doesn't balance right, so he keeps things underneath one of the legs to support it. He doesn't use lights. He likes to use the neon lights from across the road to read his books. He doesn't have to switch lights on to save money, and just a real miser. Anyway, a young entrepreneur comes into town and decides to open across the road Danny's Fried Chicken, which is, as you said, John, a very westernized sort of restaurant. Yeah,
and they also use Japanese business training techniques. That was a big controversy in the time. In the 80s, because Japan was going through an economic bubble, so their business methods were considered the best, and so it's basically Western cooking and Japanese business techniques. So it's everything that isn't Hong Kong or isn't Cantonese culture in Hong Kong.
I will say this. I think a particular film out there called Good Burger, I think whoever wrote that or directed that has riffed on this a little bit, because I'm watching this go on. Good Burger stole this whole friggin' middle section.
Oh, really?
They've ripped off the whole training techniques, like the, you know, slapping across the face and the customer's always right and all that. And just that whole section of that and the restaurant itself opening up across the road is all in Good Burger. I'm like, man, they've riffed on friggin' Chicken and Duck Talk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It didn't occur to me until I was watching this again. I thought, this is Good Burger's ripped this off. I mean, I still love Good Burger, not as much as I love this, of course, but I love Good Burger. It's a, you know, stupid dumb Nickelodeon film that a, you know, 43-year-old man sits down in his underwear and a bottle of beer and watches when he's, you know, got bugger all else to do with his time. But anyway, so Danny's Fried Chicken opens up across the road, and you know, that becomes all the rage. Everybody leaves Old Huey's, because despite the place being a dump, it's still very busy. It gets a lot of people in there, and he's well off, and he's got his staff in there. He's got his brother Ricky, who rest in peace, Ricky Huey, passed away in 2011. Huge comedic talent gone, is in there as one of his staff. And one of my favorite sequences in this, John, is when they go to some sort of desperate measure to get people back in, old Huey gets his hair done in a punk haircut.
Yes,
all spiked up, and all the other staff do it as well.
Punk haircuts must have been the funniest thing to them in the 1980s.
Totally, totally. And there's a lot of good, I mean, there's a lot of funny moments in this film, like is when the mother-in-law arrives and they're having dinner and they're talking about Madonna's boobs falling out when she's dancing on stage, and he's like, how can Madonna dance with her arms crossed, her left boob's going to pop out if she raises her arm, and there's a lot of westernized comedy in there, like references to Madonna and like with the punk haircuts, so... Do you feel what they were doing with that was being organic with their writing, or trying to aim this towards a Western audience somewhat?
I think it's probably organic with the writing, because I think I don't feel like Michael Huey, with the exception of The Private Eyes and maybe The Contract, I don't feel like he's ever consciously aimed his stuff at any outside, you know, audiences outside of Hong Kong and Taiwan.
Okay.
Western culture was pretty big in Hong Kong in the 80s, so they were familiar with our stars, and they probably found punk hilarious. Friends who've been to Hong Kong tell me that the interesting thing about Hong Kong is there, at the time, there was no alternative culture. There is no punk culture. It was like all completely mainstream populist entertainment. That's it.
Yeah.
And it's, which, of course, now that, you know, the PRC took over in 97, now you have Hong Kong punk rockers and goth rockers.
Oh, really?
I guess because there's this, you know, they were happy in this free market capitalist society. They were just happy and working hard, so mainstream entertainment was fun. But then, of course, the commies are secretly, you know, running everything, or knowingly running everything now. Now there's a reason for punk rock or alternative culture. Like, it's there now.
Wow.
But apparently not as prevalent in the 80s. I mean, this is just what somebody told me. I have never been to Hong Kong myself.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to go to Hong Kong.
Yeah, I'd love to go. I'm somewhat hesitant because, I mean, I can't afford to go right now, but it's costly. But I've often said, well, it's not going to be the city that I love in those 1980s films or 1970s films where it looks like the happiest city in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and friends have told me they're really trying to wipe out the Cantonese culture. So they said, you got to get over there and enjoy it now, because that's going to be gone in a few years.
Wow,
it's like they're really just trying to replace it, you know, with mainstream mainland Mandarin culture. And they said, and Hong Kong was always uniquely Cantonese.
Okay.
And keep in mind, the Hui brothers popularized Cantonese language cinema in Hong Kong. Before that, most movies were in Mandarin. And they kind of brought the voice of the working class into the cinemas, and they brought Cantonese cinema back. Now, then for like two decades, every movie released in Hong Kong was in Cantonese.
What was John Woo's stuff released, like The Killer and A Better Tomorrow, Hardboiled?
Cantonese in Hong Kong and Mandarin in Taiwan. If you got the Taiwanese tapes, which came out around the same time as the movie was in theaters, they were always in Mandarin. They were Mandarin dubbed because it's in Taiwan. They want their movies in Mandarin, but when you got the Hong Kong versions, those were always in Cantonese.
Okay.
They didn't do live sound back then. They didn't do sync sound. They did post dub. They shot their movies without sound because you could get the movie made quicker.
Yeah.
For one thing. And also, Hong Kong is too noisy for decent on-set recording. So, you know, they just have the actors say their dialogue, and then they're going to dub it in two or three languages, or, you know, 10 different languages later on anyway. So what was the point? And nobody cared in Hong Kong that it was dubbed later. So, but
now,
Cantonese is the original soundtrack. You can hear the Hui brothers' real voices in the Cantonese versions.
Nice. So, yeah, as we said, Danny's Fried Chicken opened up across the road by this young entrepreneur, you know, who's obviously dabbled or very, you know, invested a lot of time into sort of Western figures who are, you know, made it rich, and tried his hand at that with his fried chicken which he intends to make a chain with his what is it, that older guy is like a business associate, is he a right hand man or something
like that?
The
godfather of the chain or something.
Yeah, pretty much,
you know?
And Danny's Fried Chicken's open and becomes huge. Everyone flees, you know, old Huey's restaurant and heads over there. And even Ricky Huey decides to go and work over there at Danny's. Yeah. But the only person who remains loyal to old Huey is the monk.
Right. And his wife, played by Sylvia Chang. is incredibly loyal to him.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And her mother hates him, so there's all these mother-in-law gags.
Yeah, there is.
But Sylvia Chang was the co-star of the Aces Go Places series at Cinema City with Sam, his brother Sam, and Carl Maka.
Okay.
So, and she was Carl Maka's wife. She was married to Carl Maka for years. And, yeah, she's really good in the film. She's kind of like a Hong Kong movie legend. She also did some episodes of, at least one episode of MASH, because she spoke good English.
So really?
Yes, she actually did an episode of MASH in the 70s.
Oh, okay. Did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, like, when I saw an interview with Michael Huey, last week or something like that, and he was speaking in English to a being interviewed by a guy from England, and he almost speaks like he's an upper class Brit.
He went to an English. He and Sam both were educated in English schools. I don't know about Ricky Hui, but Sam and Michael actually went to English schools, and Sam speaks fluent English as well, and actually has an American Filipino wife.
Yeah,
he's been
yeah.
married to, it's 1971.
Wow, that's a long ass time.
Yeah,
it's a long ass time.
On Sam Hui's Facebook page, there's now an official page which with recent photos, and it's him and his wife at dinner, and he's like 65. It's like, whoa, we're all aging, man. This is crazy.
Yeah, but he looks good for his age. I mean, geez.
Oh yeah, he looks really healthy guy. So it's like he's aging well. Same with Michael, doesn't really look much older.
It looks like he's about maybe 55 at tops, Michael Hui, but he's got to be in his 70s easily.
Yeah, he's holding up fine. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
But with Ricky dying, it was kind of like, oh no, who's next? But
yeah, really.
Others healthy.
And Ricky was a big star in his own right as a musician, wasn't he?
Ricky.
Not as big as Sam, because Sam was huge.
It's hard to be that big. Like, Sam was like the Elvis of Hong Kong, like, in a massive way. Imagine if Elvis was always relevant every year he was alive with Top Records. That's Sam Hui. Like,
yeah.
He was the first guy to really sing Cantonese pop songs, and you know, he dates back to like the time of the Beatles. When the Beatles were big, Sam formed a band and then formed another band called the Lotus, which were like the Hong Kong answer to the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy. I did not know that. But
yeah, it dates back, and there used to be a Hui Brothers TV show. And I'm not
really
sure.
Okay.
Yes, and it was sketch comedy and musical numbers from Sam. So they were always somewhat established. And then Michael started making movies for the Shaw Brothers. He made like about two comedies for them. They're not quite as good as the Golden Harvest films. Like, when he broke off and went to Golden Harvest, it's more like he was making the type of movies he really wanted to make.
Okay.
And not like Shaw Brothers studio product. And they what would happen is Sam would release a song for like somebody like 4 to 6 months before the movie was coming out. The song promoted the movie, so when the Hui Brothers movie finally opened, it opened huge because they'd already kind of sold the movie through Sam's hit song.
Like they did with The Private Eyes. That was a huge big hit, that one.
Yeah, you can actually, I think you can find it on YouTube, but there's a video that was made before the movie was even shot, of a music video of Sam, you know, lip-syncing the song in Hong Kong, and it's like they hadn't even shot the movie yet.
Yeah.
It's just like, the movie's going to be based around, you know, this tune or whatever. And, of course, it's played like 4 or 5 times in the film. But
They maximized the use out of that song in the film, for sure.
Definitely. And it was just like that perfect commercial marriage of the hit song and the hit movie. And, you know, that just changed everything. And
yep.
Gave Golden Harvest the money they needed to waste on stuff like Cannonball Run and Megaforce. So.
And we should mention as well that Sam Hui actually appears in Chicken and Duck Talk very briefly as himself. Yeah. He does the opening of the Danny's Fried Chicken restaurant by cutting the ribbon. And at first, when I first saw this back in the 90s, I thought, oh, wow, they got Jackie Chan into this film. Because he does bear quite a resemblance to Jackie Chan in this. But,
as long as he keeps sunglasses on. So.
Yeah, really. But then I realized as I watched it progress a bit, it was actually Sam Hui. It was because I didn't know he was that big a star in Hong Kong or in Asia. I had no idea. Yeah. That's why he'd... although, why the hell is Sam Hui doing this? But then I realized that I read up there was a huge pop star. So Danny's Fried Chicken takes off. Huge hit. And we get the one shot of old Huey dressed as an old Indian lady, disguising himself to go in there to find out what the secret is to their success. Yeah. And he's getting hit upon by this guy from a table across the way who's actually Indian as well, like a Pakistani or something. And
right.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away in these. I'll just say what they are, but because I want to watch this film. We want to watch this film, I should say. But, John, I think what's the most inventive scene in this film, it's one that's never been done anywhere that I've ever seen in a Hollywood feature, and thank God, because if they did, they would have CGI'd the shit out of it, is the scene with the rats.
Yeah, I thought the rat scene was the most hilarious.
It was so clever. So brilliantly made. We're not going to tell you what happens. If you've got an aversion to rats, you're probably not going to like this.
No,
because these rats are the size of fucking dogs, just about. They're enormous.
They look like the Boston sewer rats that I would sometimes see in Boston. I would literally walk down the street and go, oh, what a cute puppy. Oh, wait, that's not a puppy. That's how fucking big they are. I was like, good Lord.
Jesus. That reminds me of a YouTube video, which was a video of this rat in New York actually walking home carrying a piece of pizza.
Oh, my God.
It's insane.
Not surprising.
Yeah. Surprising. Yeah. But this scene with the rats is so funny. I hate rodents. I've got a massive fear of mice and rats. I absolutely fucking hate them. But even I can watch this and still laugh. It's so clever what happens with it. And as I said, if this was done in a Hollywood film, no effing way would they allow rats to be crawling all over them and then place bowls all over their bodies and... He'd be like, yeah, you can CGI all that shit in later, and we'll just mimic this out right now.
Yeah.
You can work it out later. But these things were real, weren't they, John?
Yes. It's like
they were not clockwork, they were not CGI, definitely. Of course.
The cast was doing their own stunts for that scene.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I tell you, it's
although to be fair, I've heard rats are actually the ones you buy at the pet store are great pets. And, you know, I don't want to diss rats, but it's like we have a natural aversion and fear of them. That's why I have three cats in the house at all times.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, field mice or country mice are actually a real problem in Colorado.
Oh,
like,
geez.
If you don't have cats in your house, you may have to deal with a mouse problem, and we've had no issue ever.
Yeah, so that scene with the rats, it's just very, very funny. I'm glad Hollywood's never ripped it off into another film.
Except for Good Burger.
Well, yeah, not with the rats anyway. They never did that. They only did the business training section. That was it. But glad. Actually, I'm glad this film never got remade. I can honestly say I'm glad Hollywood never got their fucking dirty paws on it and remade it. Because, you know, damn well it would have been a complete disaster. It would be nowhere near as good as this.
They couldn't even figure out how to do it, I think. It reminds me when Stephen Chow's Got a Cookery was a hit. Farrelly Brothers optioned it for an American remake. It wasn't the Farrelly Brothers, it was Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey had optioned it, but had no idea how to adapt it to America, because Iron Chef, it was a spoof of the whole Iron Chef popularity in the Far East.
Yeah.
And at that time, Iron Chef was not shown in America, so Jim Carrey had no idea how to adopt it for Hollywood. He showed it to the Farrelly Brothers, and they said, we think this is a funny movie, but we have no idea how you would even adapt this for the Western audience at all. So I think that there's a lot of things in Chicken and Duck Talk that would make it almost untranslatable to American audiences.
Yeah,
I mean, nowadays, though, with the Anthony Bourdain popularity, the whole idea of a foodie is more of a mainstream hipster idea. Whereas back in the 80s, that was more something you might encounter in Hong Kong than, you know, America.
And it wouldn't be a duck restaurant anyway, because how many duck restaurants are there in America?
They don't exist. Outside of Chinatowns, they don't exist.
Exactly, outside of Chinatown. Yeah, so that cancels out half the bloody story as it is. It's a duck restaurant. You'll have to adapt it to something else. What are you going to do?
Exactly. Okay.
Well, you got a fried chicken place. Well, they're everywhere, so that's
fried
nothing.
Smoked turkey? I have no idea. You know, and I can't think of anything like that.
Yeah,
but duck's not a big is not a big food item in America. Even though we have duck hunting, and you can buy duck, and there's duck soup at restaurants, but it's not a big thing. Not as popular as chicken or beef.
See, you'd think they would have cashed in on this with the Duck Dynasty craze of a film, which is now, you know,
yeah,
now past.
Well, the funny thing is, that's what baffles me. It's like, but I think people are horrified with the idea of eating duck for some reason.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I know. It's like, well, I read this book called The Foie Gras Wars, and it was all about the controversy over foie gras and all these kind of crazed animal rights types that are protesting restaurants that serve it. And when you read the book, it's funny because in France, they think if you want to save a duck's life from being eaten, or if you tell them you're a vegetarian, they think something's wrong with you. They'll go, "Do you need to go to the hospital? Are you okay?" You know, like that's how the French view it. They have no idea. This whole feeling bad for animals like that is actually a very new belief in the human race.
Oh man, I tell you what, if I had walked into a restaurant somewhere in the world, or let's say America, and said, "Can I get some barbecue lime?" when that whole Cecil bullshit happened, they would have lynched me. Yeah, it's like, really, yeah, see the funny side of it.
But, oh yeah, well, everybody's like, "Oh, I feel sorry for the lion." It's like that happens all the time in Africa, and lions kill people in Africa, so they don't view it the same way you do.
Well, shit, a guy in New Zealand got killed by a tiger, and guess what? Well, we're not putting the tiger down. Well, why the fuck not?
Right.
Everybody wanted this dentist head after he killed Cecil. Poor Cecil. Everybody wanted the fucking dentist head, and, you know, writing, scrawling, you know, murder on his garage door. It's like, grow the fuck up, people. Really? Yeah.
All the things going on in the world, and you give a fuck about some animal that's killed on a regular basis in Africa.
And yet, Mugabe eats half a fucking zoo, and,
right.
No one cares. Is it Mugabe eats elephants? No one cares. Oh,
it's such idiocy. It's just like, I don't know what's going on with the human race right now.
Really?
We've really lost a lot of connection with nature and reality. It's just, it's the internet generation, it has to be.
It is. It really is. It's like, oh, I'm appalled. I'm shocked. I'm appalled. No, you're not. Because I'm, I'm bloody not. That's for damn sure. But let me ask you, you ever eaten duck at all, John?
Yeah, I've eaten it in Chinatown restaurants, and I have had duck gumbo when I was growing up in New Orleans.
That duck
was
gumbo, wow.
Yes.
Crazy. Really
good. Haven't had it in years. I don't know what I think of it now, but I liked it when I was a little kid.
Oh, it's so good, I tell you. When it's done, if you cook it right.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, tomorrow I'm going to head to my local Aldi and pick up a mini spit roast, and I'm going to be cooking my duck on that. I can't wait. Because I haven't got the temperament like Michael Huey has in this to stick a duck on a skewer and just keep turning it for about 2 hours. I haven't got that sort of, I don't know how the hell he does that with his ducks, but sure looks good when he's cooking them. But no, I think I'll stick mine on a mini spit and on a rotisserie and let it cook for a couple of hours on that over some hot coals. But I love it. I collect duck fat after you cooked it, which might sound weird, but that, if you get a couple of spoons of duck fat when it's hardened up into a white lard, and you cook some, like you roast some potatoes or something like that, holy shit, it tastes like nothing else. It's fucking insane.
Apparently, I need to go eating in Australia for a long time.
Yeah.
I think you guys actually like to cook food and enjoy different types of food.
Oh god, yeah.
America's hamburgers and, you know, chicken, that's about it.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many Asian restaurants over here. God, I've eaten duck at them. I can't even think how many times over the years. Many, many times. And yeah, but I collected duck fat, and like I said, it might sound weird. Oh boy, you cooking that stuff. Because if you try and buy it, it's ridiculous. Like a small tub is about $15. I'm like, well, fuck, I can get a whole ton of duck fat out of one duck, because they're a very fatty animal. Once you've rendered down all the fat out of them, there's a lot in there, and you save it. Let it cool, and you save that in a container and cook with that later. Holy shit. It's incredible. Gosh. Yeah. But what more you want to say on chicken and duck talk? What did you think of it a second time around after having not seen it for so many years?
I enjoyed it a lot more. I'm a lot more knowledgeable about the Hong Kong culture at the time. And also, I have such a fondness for that decade in Hong Kong cinema. Like, to me, that's just when they were just knocking them out of the park, like every week in their theaters, with just really inventive movies. And they were making, like, even the B movies were great back then.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that was such a fun era. And of course, it wasn't going to last that long, because about after 92, a lot of their cinema is unwatchable. But yeah, I had such a fondness going back and visit any film from that era out of Hong Kong that I was just, I had a blast and got more of the jokes than I did in 96 or 95 whenever I first watched it. Because it's just like, you know, I just know more about the culture and the culture wars and the and also knowing what Michael Hui has said about the film, that like Hong Kong was this big food city and yet they were allowing these Western companies to come in and open up joints and people were flocking to them for the Western food. So they were like, I guess he felt like Hong Kong should have stood its ground food-wise against the encroaching West.
Yeah.
I appreciate the humor, too. It's just like, it's just a blast, and seeing Ricky Hui be funny is always a joy. And Michael Hui being the usual arrogant jerk that has to ethically do the right thing in the third act is always, it's always fun, because like, I just love those comedies so much.
Yeah, but as I said before, it's not mean-spirited in any way. It's
no.
I mean, really, you really could sit your kids down, you know, if they're inclined to sit there and read subtitles. And right. I mean, it's pretty much a family movie, but it's not as well. But I mean, I think it still cracks me up every time I watch it. And like, as I said, I've seen it about 15 times easily. It may be more, maybe slightly more than that. Now, in the pantheon of Hui Brothers films, where would you sort of rate this one?
It's probably holds up a little better than Games Gamblers Play, which is a film that I always found an interesting watch, but I don't find it that funny, and I think the subtitles maybe don't carry over a lot of the humor. And I don't consider it an official Hui Brothers movie because Sam Hui is not beyond a cameo in the closing credits song, so you know, barely there. I mean, it's a really great film or really good movie, but I don't really rank it with the Hui Brothers comedies as an actual Hui Brothers comedy.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. But I mean, it's a Michael and Ricky film, but it's terrific. It's one of the best Hong Kong comedies of the 80s. I mean, it's probably neck and neck with Security Unlimited and The Contract, which both of which I like those a lot. So.
Okay, so how would you place up against Private Eyes?
Private Eyes is probably my second favorite Hui Brothers comedy, so...
Okay.
It's close. I mean, it's highly... They're both incredibly enjoyable movies and rewatchable, which is not something you can say about a lot of comedies today, most comedies today. You know, my favorite is actually The Last Message, which is nobody's favorite, but it's my favorite for whatever reason.
Okay.
Like, that's the weirdest, most bizarre, most original of the Hui Brothers comedies for me. Like, there's nothing taken from... Like, Private Eyes recycles a lot of jokes from Blake Edwards' Pink Panther films. Like, there's a couple of gags, like him with the binoculars, I think, and he's looking at somebody, and then he follows a girl in a bikini who dives into a swimming pool, and he goes into the pool or whatever. You know, it's you've seen Clouseau do the gag in A Shot in the Dark.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and it's like... But Last Message is the most original. It's such a weird film, and the strange thing about The Last Message is Michael Hui is playing the Sam Hui role. Sam Hui is playing the Michael Hui role.
Oh.
So it's a really weird role reversal. And the music's fantastic, and it's got some really strange scenes in it that, I mean, setting it in like a, I think it's set in a mental hospital. I mean, you're going to get some weirdness, but that's the most original and unique of their comedies. But it's my favorite, but I love The Private Eyes. And I love Chicken and Duck Talk a lot, but it probably... And I love The Contract. There's none of them I don't like. I'll still sit through Games Gamblers Play, even though I don't even get most of the jokes, just because it's so visually odd.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
And the timing... this is something that's missing from movies today. The comic timing of Michael Hui.
Oh.
Sam Hui. And,
so
and the
good.
Ricky Hui comics. You still appreciate that in Games Gamblers Play, even if the subtitles really don't carry the humor over for the you know, the non-Cantonese speaker.
Yeah, like I said,
the facial expressions when he's busted still cracks me up.
You know? Yeah, so funny, Hui Brothers. I mean, guys out there listening, honestly, give them a chance. Okay, yeah, you're gonna have to read subtitles, you have to listen to them in native language, but for God's sake, really. Try and catch a Hui Brothers movie. Try and catch Chicken and Duck Talk, Private Eyes, Contract. Catch one of them because you're really gonna enjoy yourself. You're gonna go, wow, Asian Marx Brothers, cool. Only funnier than the Marx Brothers, and I like the Marx Brothers. Love the Marx Brothers, but like the Hui Brothers more. So Chicken and Duck Talk. What are you gonna give this out of a 10?
I'll give it like a probably an 8.5.
Oh, that's high for you. Okay, that's high for you.
Maybe even close to a 9. It's very close to a 9.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a... Oh, man, I can't give it less than a 10. It's too... Yeah. I got too much of a fondness for it. And, I know, okay, yeah, you just gave Up the Academy 9.5 to it, so you're probably going to re-rate this. No, I'm not. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie. It's not. But to me, like, I give Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park a 10, but it's goddamn far from a 10, really. But it's just one of those films that's just, it's comforting to me. I can just put it on. I can even put this on in the background and, of course, not understand a word they're saying, but it's one of those films for me. So I'm going to give it a 10. Yeah, I give it a 10. Yeah. I love it that much. And, I saw it again yesterday. I want to watch it again now. So,
want to go back. I watched Security Unlimited last week.
Yeah.
And the last one of my Blu-ray set I had not watched. And I said, you know what? I want to go back and just watch their movies again. And I want to open up my Aces Go Places box set and watch those movies. And,
nice.
You know, it's like there's just too much out there that I want to just re-enjoy and quit watching all these new films. God, what a waste of time they always are.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Folks, Seth Rogen is not the be-all in all comedies. Far from it. He's not the answer.
Hey, pot!
Who let these rats in here?
We're not gay. We swear.
Jesus, who's this Danny's Fried Chicken? I need to shut this down.
Hey, rats! Hey, that's not a roach. Hey.
No, thanks. I'll stick to the Hui Brothers any day. Okay, now, availability of these, we're going to put them up in the show notes for you. If you want to watch Chicken and Duck Talk, it's on iTunes now. Thankfully, it's only just come on iTunes the last few months. You can get it out there on an SD version, or there is a HD one on there. I think the HD is like $7.99 to own, or $4 to rent. The SD is only $5 to own, and to rent, I don't know, maybe $2 or $3. It's not much, but you're going to enjoy it. I really think you're going to be impressed with the Hui Brothers and want to get their other stuff. Now, John, you said you've got a Blu-ray box set. There is two of them, but you own the first one, don't you?
I own the first one with the original Golden Harvest run of the Hui Brothers.
Yeah.
And that is still in print. It's pricey, but for me it's worth it. You could probably still find the remastered DVD versions through some Asian retailers, and they do show up on eBay, but I think the Blu-ray box set's great, and I believe it's region-free friendly, so... You know, you can watch it on any Blu-ray player.
Which reminds me, I do need to hit my local Chinatown and see if they've got the Blu-ray of this. I'm doubting it because the last experience I had in there, which was, I don't know, maybe a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, pretty much seemed to be just new movies. That's all I cared about. Like, new, up-to-date, current crop. They don't want a film from 88 and who the hell.
They don't like old movies. I think the only old movies only sell to foreigners who love these films.
Probably. And you know, the stores that I, you know, the Asian shops I still were populated by teenagers and the like. And who the hell are Hui Brothers then? They probably don't even know of them, you know?
No.
You and I know of them. They probably don't even know them. Who the hell is that? Who the hell is Ricky Hui? They don't care. They don't care, which is sad because it's a part of their culture that, they should be spending some time on and not watching another film by Dwayne Johnson or what the fuck his name is, The Rock, you know.
The Rock. Vin Diesel. They're watching The Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, really? No, thanks.
San Andreas.
Oh, don't even get me started. I saw that trailer somewhere. I'm like, No. I mean, fuck new movies. I can't stand them. I really can't stand them, you know.
I hate them.
Just, I mean, if there's a third Sin City film, I will go see because I want to see what they can do next. Mm-hmm. If that Machete Kills in Space or Machete Kills Again in Space comes out, I'm going to wait for reviews. I want to, because the whole In Space bit is like, really? Okay, whatever. But
well, it's like you're spoofing Moonraker, which is like the Bond movie nobody wants to revisit.
And Moonraker was spoofed by Star Crash, wasn't it? The Roger Corman flick or something? Or
no, it's funny because Austin Powers 2 is the spoof of Moonraker, but Moonraker's already almost a self-joke on the Bond series, so it's like, how can you spoof a spoof?
It's because Moonraker's shit, that's why.
I know.
I do not like it at all.
It's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, when I finish collecting these bonds, because I bought them singly, I'm not going to buy them in the box and be bound to what's in the box, and all the other future titles are out in a separate title on them shell on their own. So that's why I didn't buy the box. I bought them singly. I'm still collecting the bonds, and Moonraker is going to be the last, unless it's like some stupid price of $5, and I'll grab it. But
I had the whole series on DVD, and then we watched Diamonds Are Forever because we were trying to watch them all in order.
Yeah,
and I traded in Diamonds Are Forever like the next week.
It's bad, isn't it?
It's bad. Awful. And now next up is Live and Let Die. I think that might hold up okay. Man with a Golden Gun, I'm not so sure. But you got the Christopher Lee performance.
Actually, Man with a Golden Gun is really—it's a really solid one. It's one of those ones that just sort of, you know, flies in under the radar of Bond movies. But Man with a Golden Gun, I really like that a lot.
Yeah, Spy Who Loved Me, I love. So I'm expecting to dig that. And then I did get Moonraker because it was only $4 at the time. And
yeah.
Oof, boy, that's probably going to hit the trade-in bin. So
yeah,
I'm already expecting it.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, that's it for this week. Back next week, and Mr. Arrow Shelf will be joining us again next week, he assures us. So,
oh, Mr. Arrow Shelf.
It's why he couldn't. Exactly. That's why I think he couldn't make it this week. Like, I got them Arrow titles. Like, guys, you have to go without me this week. Oh, I'm too busy with school. Oh, read new Arrow titles to watch. So,
yeah, he's watching the Blu-ray of Day of Anger or something.
Yeah, probably. He'll probably expose him. He'll expose himself next week when we go, oh, so Hunter, what have you been watching? Oh, all these old Arrow titles. Ah, that's why you wanted the show last week. Yeah. But before we go, I want to give a shout-out to a podcast out there called They Must Be Destroyed on Sight. I've only heard a few episodes previously up until recently when I started downloading a few more. They're a very, very funny show. I barely listen to movie podcasts these days. I know, I'm sorry, I sound like a snob. These days I'm more just inclined to listen to music ones like Eddie Trunk, and I'm even starting to wane off some of the Kiss ones. I'm like, getting sick of the infighting and hearing about Tommy Thayer and Ace Frehley's makeup. It's like, I'm just getting bored of it. But I really am. I'm getting tired of it. And I've actually started listening to Dee Snider's one a lot. Snider Comments. And really enjoying that. But They Must Be Destroyed on Sight. I listened to their sex comedy series. And really funny. Non-PC as well, like us, which I appreciate quite a bit.
So they really are un-PC.
They really are, yeah.
A lot of people claim they are, but they are not. They're just as... like the same as everybody.
No, they really are, and openly talk about this sex comedy didn't have enough tits in it or something. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. You guys can say that without any self censoring. But like I said, the sex comedy series was great. I really enjoyed it. I've started to delve into some of their other ones as well, and but not on iTunes, guys. Get yourselves on iTunes, please.
Yeah, I just did a search, and it's kind of like on YouTube.
YouTube only, or you have to get them over on... okay, now get your pen and paper out, kids. tmbdos.podbean.com. That's where you'll get them. And go check them out. Lee Russell over there always supports his show a lot. He's a host of that, along with Daniel... And the other guy, I think his name's Paul as well. Great show. Check it out. Really, really enjoying it. Maybe want to actually go and break out my old sex comedy section on my shelf in the garage. And I tell you what, if you want to hear a really... You're probably going to laugh, John. You really want to hear a really, really deep and detailed analysis of the Revenge of the Nerds series, check that episode out. It is crazy. Crazy some of the things that... they bring up on there. It's like, holy shit, I didn't even realize that. And it made me actually watch Revenge of the Nerds 2 again upstairs. I'm like, oh, God, this film's fucking horrible. It is bad. I mean, it started off okay, but then it just plummeted into the pit of shit.
They did an episode, they did one on the party animal, which was like one of the craziest obscurities of teen sex comedies in the 80s.
Yeah, a really good podcast. Go check it out, guys. They Must Be Destroyed on Sight. Well done, guys. You're doing an awesome job. And Yeah, on that note, we'll say goodbye for this week. So I'll imitate Hunter and go adios.
And I'll say mahalo as usual.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MM Cowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time. Yeah.